From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the man who brought us the music of the Supremes, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Little Stevie Wonder, and the Jackson 5. We meet the founder of Motown Records, Berry Gordy. Also, we talk with actor and writer Chaz Palminteri. He plays the gangster writer in Woody Allen's latest film, Bullets Over Broadway. Palminteri wrote the screenplay for A Bronx Tale and co-starred in the film with Robert De Niro. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Our Cancer Year, a new book-length comic by Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner about his battle with cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida Governor Lawton Childs has declared a state of emergency in Central and South Florida, where Tropical Storm Gordon has come ashore. Valerie Alker of member station WSFP reports from Fort Myers.
Tropical Storm Gordon came ashore this morning just south of Fort Myers and is headed northeast back across the state. National Hurricane Center forecaster Max Mayfield says Gordon may weaken to a depression later today or tonight, but could rejuvenate.
It's a large circulation. It's not going to go away. And as it eases out here over the Atlantic and over the warm waters of the Gulf Stream, it could re-intensify again as it gets over the Atlantic.
Most of the wind and rain associated with Gordon are to the east and south of the storm, where a flood watch remains in effect. Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties, which have had heavy rains for 3 days, can expect still more wet weather. For National Public Radio, I'm Valerie Alker in Fort Myers.
Pentagon officials announced that U.S. fighting forces are below the top level of combat readiness. They say 5 of 12 divisions don't meet the standard, and 3 of them need significant compensation to make up for the lack. But the officials say there is no immediate threat to national security. Republicans are blasting President Clinton for neglecting the military. Pentagon officials claim the cost of peacekeeping missions is the main problem. Defense Secretary William Perry says Congress shares the blame for not moving faster on emergency funding requests. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic is calling on Western countries to stabilize the critical situation around the northwestern enclave of Bihać. Bosnian Serb forces are attacking the region, trying to regain territory recently lost to the Bosnian army. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Zagreb.
Izetbegovic said the Bosnian Serb army is attacking along a 65-mile-long front line using dozens of tanks and heavy artillery. Bosnian government forces, who launched a stunning offensive against the Serb army 2 weeks ago, have been forced to retreat almost back to the point from which they started. Rebel Serb forces in neighboring Croatia, who had stayed out of the Bosnian war until now, have joined in the attacks around Bihać, according to United Nations and diplomatic sources. U.S. officials are pushing NATO governments to declare a heavy weapons exclusion zone around Bihać, which would force the Serbs to withdraw their artillery from the area or face NATO airstrikes. France is arguing against the proposal, however, pointing out it was the Bosnian government army, not the Serbs, that provoked the Bihać fighting in the first place. I'm Tom Jelton in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 15 points to 3,841. Trading is heavy on volume of 288 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down a fraction at 768. This is NPR. The Clinton administration is focusing attention on Asia in the effort to stop drug trafficking. White House Drug Policy Director Lee Brown says 70% of illegal drugs sold in the United States come from Asian countries. Brown says he's trying to get Asian governments to tighten their drug enforcement to cut off the flow at its source. Brown's in India today after meeting with officials in Pakistan. Much of the Asian drug trade passes through those two countries, but India and Pakistan are enemies and refuse to work together on drug control measures. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has started a week-long visit to the United States. He'll meet with President Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials say Prime Minister Rabin has two issues on his agenda. Peace talks between Israel and Syria are now stalled. Rabin wants to discuss the possibility of U.S. observers being stationed in the Golan Heights as part of any security arrangements. Rabin will also meet Republican leaders such as Jesse Helms, who will chair the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to discuss U.S. foreign aid to Israel. Helms yesterday said he has no intention of cutting aid to Israel, despite his feelings against foreign aid in general. Israel currently receives $3 billion a year, the most of any country. Some in Israel say that Jerusalem should consider giving up part of that money, since Israel's economic situation has improved. About $1 billion a year goes to repay Israeli debts to the United States. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Exxon says it signed an agreement with the Indonesian government to spend up to $40 billion to develop a natural gas field in the South China Sea. The agreement clears the way for both partners to seek buyers of liquefied natural gas in Asia. Exxon says if there's sufficient demand, the project could require 18 offshore platforms. The field is thought to have enough reserves to produce about 2 billion cubic feet of gas every day for more than 30 years. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Someone I've needed so long. For once
Motown Records with a soundtrack for a lot of people who came of age in the 60s. Great dance records and soul ballads by performers like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Gladys Knight and the Pips, The Temptations, The Four Tops, The Supremes, Mary Wells, and Little Stevie Wonder. The ups and downs of the Motown story have been told by its performers, but now founder Berry Gordy has told his version of the story in his new autobiography, To Be Loved. Gordy's formula for success combined competition and cooperation. Friday mornings, he ran meetings in which the label's songwriters and producers played their latest tracks and then voted on which would be released. Some records never made it. Some were sent back to be reworked. Berry Gordy told me the story of what happened during the Friday meeting that Norman Whitfield played his production of The Temptations, singing Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
My comment was I didn't really believe David Ruffin was really begging. He didn't sound like he was begging. He didn't sound like a man in pain. So after a couple of weeks, Norman came back the next week, and it was better, but we turned it down. Again, for some of the same kind of reasons. The following week, Norman came in there, and David Ruffin's voice jumped off that record. You know, I know what you want. I mean, I'm hoarse, but you know what I mean. The record, he jumped off there. I mean, he was like singing for dear life. I mean, you would know that was a smash. And Norman had the fire. Norman brought the fire out.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, and you know it. Please don't leave me, girl.
As a part of the system you created at Motown was, if a record wasn't good, that kind of forced the person to either give up on the record or to do it better. So there was this always pressure to do it again, do it better. Well, here's another story with that. Tell the I Heard It Through the Grapevine story, how that got changed at a Friday morning meeting.
Well, it didn't get changed. It's just that we rejected the first one on Marvin Gaye. And that was also done by Norman Whitfield.
Norman Whitfield had produced Marvin Gaye singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
He had produced it on Marvin Gaye. But at that time, Marvin Gaye was singing love-type songs. I told the producers I thought that Marvin had this great sexual image, and he was so great and had this wonderful, smooth voice. And I wanted them to think about doing you-type songs, you know, you singing directly to women, you know, because I just felt that would be good. So they did that. Marvin was very successful with that. You are my pride and joy. You are a wonderful one, you know. And he even had one words, you. In the mirror, I look in the mirror and I see you. So it was really working really well. And then finally, Norman came up with this song, Grapevine. I heard it through Grapevine. It was about gossip and, you know, Love Me No More. It was still a love-type song, but I wanted Marvin to stay where he was. So we had a thing that Holland Dozier Holland had written called Your Unchanging Love, but it was you, your unchanging, talking directly to the women. And we released that instead of Grapevine. And so Norman was very upset. So later he then produced Grapevine on Gladys Knight. And it went to number one. And of course, and Your Unchanging Love didn't do that well. and Norman never let me forget it. So a year later, he kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me to release it again. I said, wait a minute, it's already been out. It's been number one. And you can't, you know, I mean, it's been a year. It's just number one. And so Norman said, well, I was right before and you were wrong before. So I want the record released and blah, blah, blah. It's all in the book. And he followed me around. So we ended up releasing the record in an album.
The Marvin Gaye version of Grapevine.
The Marvin Gaye version in one of Marvin's albums.
Mm-hmm.
We released Grapevine, and the disc jockeys loved it so much they played it, and we had to pull it off the album, and it went also to number one and sold even more than the original Grapevine did.
I guess this taught you to not always trust your taste, but to trust the process that you had set in motion.
That's right. The process was the thing. We're all humans, and we all have our thoughts and ideas. But as long as it was a free society, and people could win by logically winning, they had to have a point. They had to be right. Two and two is four, I'd always say, you know. And long as they knew they could do that, that's what made Motown so different. They weren't locked in. They didn't come to a place where they were, like, limited. They could dream anything, and it could be possible.
My guest is Berry Gordy, if you're just joining us. The founder of Motown Records has finally written his memoir. It's called To Be Loved. It's interesting to me that sometimes after a record came out, you decided, no, I don't like it. I'm going to do it again. So when Smokey Robinson's Shop Around came out, you described you were listening to it on the radio and you thought, the beat's too slow. We got to get back into the studio and redo it. Well, now how can you do that once the record's already been out? Disc jockeys have it. Disc jockeys are playing it on the air. Isn't it too late?
They said it was in the company, but I said no. I was petrified at the fact that this record was too slow. It sounded too slow. It had sounded great before, but somehow when I'm listening to it, I'm saying I'm pulling the record. It's going and it's just chugging along. And I'm saying, and after 3 days, I couldn't sleep and I just said, hey, I got to do it again. And I don't know what the problems are going to be. I don't know what it is. All I know is I got to get this record out and tell them to send back the other ones. And it was probably a crazy thought, but it wasn't crazy because no thoughts are crazy. So I called Smokey at 3 a.m. in the morning and woke him up. He got in the studio. We recorded the song. The piano player didn't show up, so I played. But I had the life. And Smokey felt it when it was picked up a little bit, and he even got a little more life. And then, of course, when the record went to number one or number two or whatever, a big, big hit, it was just... It was great. But it was a trouble. It was trouble changing it, but it hadn't been out long enough to really take hold. And a lot of people didn't know it was a different record. We just sent it out again. And so somehow the very first one had not really picked up that many stations, and it wasn't ingrained in, I know when my publisher read that, she read that story, and she said, I hope you don't have any ideas like that about the book.
Right. I figured she'd be thinking that. Well, why don't we hear Shop Around, the faster version, I suppose.
Yes.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
My guest is Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Berry Gordy, he's written his autobiography called To Be Loved. Tell me the story of how you found the Supremes.
They came in to audition for me, three young girls in the early 60s, and they were called the Primettes, and I thought they had something. I heard them and their lead singer with their little whiny voice, which was Diane Ross at the time, and I really liked them.
What did you hear and see in the Supremes that made you realize they could really make it?
Well, I saw an electrifying personality in the lead singer and a very enthusiastic feelings from the other two girls, and each one seemed to have had a different personality, but all of it was they were young and they were eager and then they were cute.
You and Diana Ross became lovers. You write in your book that you were both very discreet, although you figured everybody at Motown probably knew. Martha Reeves, in her recent autobiography, said that she felt you were paying so much attention to Diana Ross that you were paying less attention to the other women artists, particularly less attention to Martha Reeves. Did you ever worry about that yourself, that your attention to Diana Ross might happen at the expense of time you could be spending with others, or at least that they would perceive it that way?
Well, no, I never thought about it because at the time that I took interest in the Supremes, it was long before I had interest in Diana Ross on a personal level. And it was because the Supremes were able to do Broadway-type songs and they had put on A Happy Face, You Know By That Somebody Loves You, and Rockabye Your Baby and Dixie Melody and things like that that impressed me so much without a piano. They were so great. That gave me the idea to expand our base. So I was fighting hard to get them to do that on TV because no one would let them do it on national TV, only their hits. I knew that if I could get the Supremes to break through in this area and get into the Copacabana, for instance, it would be at the benefit of the other artists. And it was, because Martha and the Vandellas never would have gotten into the Copa had the Supremes not gone there first and opened the doors, not only for other Motown acts, but for acts around the world. I mean, of our same kind of acts, you know. And so that was the thing. So it is, I think that when Martha and the other artists read my book, they will get the same kind of reaction that Diana got and Smokey got and all the rest of them that read it and really understood. Smokey already knew what I was going through because he was with me before the company, and he saw me get that check for $3.19 or whatever, and he knew what I was going through, so he always had a lot of sympathy for me. But the other artists that just came along and went into that front door and came out another door star, and they had to go through this whole cycle of success of being famous and all this stuff, and so naturally, if I'm not there and I'm with another group that I really thought had great possibilities to take us to new horizons, and that's what I did with them. And it is true that I spent a tremendous time with Diana, and it did take me away from a lot of things, you know, a lot of things. But I'm certainly very happy I did, because everybody benefited by the Supremes' success. They were the first to get a number one record in Great Britain, and then everybody went over there. I mean, so they're international stars today, in part because of the way the Supremes opened doors.
Now, in the book, you write about the child you had with Diana Ross. After you had separated, she got married, had a child, and you say as you watched the child grow, you realized this child was yours. So when she was pregnant, you didn't know.
That's right. That's right.
What was it like to find out afterwards?
Well, what was it like? I don't know. Mixed emotions, obviously. But you know, when we realized that it was a possibility, it was a very interesting feeling. You know, I mean, first of all, I was very proud in one sense. And very kind of shocked in another, and I couldn't figure it out. And then we figured out that we had been together one time after we broke up, and obviously that had to be the time. So that's what it was. And when things are, we deal with them. You know, that just happened to be a situation that we had to deal with, and we didn't think anything. That just happened, and it's one of those things. I was, frankly, I've always loved the little girl. You know, she's always called me Uncle Bibi, and I was a friend of the families. And the other kids were, when they were born, I've been so close to the family that it wasn't a major, I don't think, trauma for Rhonda.
Now, let me ask you to tell the story of one of the songs that you wrote. Why don't we do Do You Love Me? This is a song that you wrote. You even did the demo for it, right? The demo recording?
Yes, I did.
Now, this is a song about somebody who is asking, do you love me now that I can dance?
Yes.
Do you dance?
Yes, somewhat now.
Somewhat.
I mean, I haven't, okay. For a long time, I've been writing a book, and I haven't done a lot of anything for the last 5 years. But that was the song that I remembered when I was going to dance, is that I had trouble dancing well enough for the girls to like to dance with me. You know, the other guys were always smoother, better dancers, better looking. It was always, I was not quite good enough. But dancing was a big deal in our neighborhood, and I couldn't dance. But later on, when I was in the record business and I wanted to write a song, I thought there must be other people like me. There must be other people that feel the same as I do. So every song I wrote started out something that I felt, but that I also felt that everybody felt, because I realized we're all really the same. We want happiness. We want love. We want peace. We want, you know, it's a matter of us communicating that to each other. And then we will basically kind of love each other because we want the same things. So I felt that that would be the situation with this song. And so I just said, you broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. But now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. Dun, 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 dun. Do you love me? And I had this growly, rough voice. And of course, the contours they had, a guy named Billy Gordon, and he heard. And I made a demo after the session. I was so excited, and I sung the whole song in my gritty, low voice, and people said, oh boy, you should record that. You should record that. I said, no way, no way. And then he sang it just like my demo, but much better.
You broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down.
Do you love me? I'm in the groove.
Do you love me?
Do
Motown is the only record company I know of that had an anthem. It was written by Smokey Robinson.
Yes.
How did it go?
It was we'd all get together in the company meetings, and whenever we closed the meeting, we'd always sing the anthem song, and everybody just had such fun singing that, and it sort of went like, oh, we are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville, USA. Our employees must be neat and clean and really have something on the ball. Da, da, da. Honesty is our only policy. We're one for all and... Now we're all for one and one for all. Yes, we are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville. I said Hitsville, yeah. I said Hitsville, USA.
Oh, that's so funny because it sounds more like a high school. What's the alma mater, you know,
right,
than,
right. Well, that's
than like a Smokey Robinson song.
That's right. Well, that's one of his proudest songs, believe it or not. He because he was in a contest, and we had contests for everything.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay, we need a company song, and I wanted to sound like those rah-rah songs. I wanted to sound like a college anthem or whatever would make inspire esprit de corps what I'm looking for here. And they all had a contest, and Smokey came up with it.
Barry Gordy, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Barry Gordy is the founder of Motown Records. His new autobiography is called To Be Loved. Gordy sold Motown in 1988 for $61 million. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Chaz Palminteri. He describes himself as an actor who likes to write. And that's a good thing because it was his writing that pulled him out of 15 years of acting obscurity. Palminteri wrote the screenplay for the movie A Bronx Tale, directed by Robert De Niro. Palminteri and De Niro also starred in the film. Now Palminteri co-stars in Woody Allen's new movie Bullets Over Broadway as a gangster who discovers his gift for writing. And Ken Tucker reviews a new book-length comic by Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner about the year Pekar spent undergoing treatment for cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida is under a state of emergency. Governor Lawton Chiles has responded to the damage caused by Tropical Storm Gordon. The American Red Cross has moved its teams into the affected area. Mike Barnes is with the Red Cross chapter in Martin County, Florida. He says flooding there is extensive.
In Martin County, the current situation as of Wednesday afternoon is that in the southern part of our county, an area known as Hobe Sound, we've received reports of widespread flooding. We do have a shelter opened up in that area. Red Cross workers are going throughout the area to determine the extent of the damage. We're still getting rain, and according to the Weather Service, we'll continue getting rain through tonight, so we don't know what that's going to do to the level of the water. Most of the flooding is freshwater flooding from rainwater that's backed up and is in streets and is starting to get into people's houses.
Weather forecasters say top sustained winds are still at 45 miles per hour. The storm center is 50 miles southwest of Melbourne and moving northeast. A group that studies insurance rates finds injury claims are driving up the cost of auto insurance. The nonprofit Insurance Research Council finds medical claims paid by auto insurers increased by $3,000 on the average over a five-year period. That's despite the fact many of the cases involve less serious injuries, shorter hospital stays, and fewer disabilities. The council's report finds the cost of claims for injured people was about four times higher than it was in 1977 when the council did its first study. The incoming Republican majority is rather divided on trade. Conservative leaders disagree on what to do about GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
Jesse Helms of North Carolina, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, wants to put GATT off until next year so he can chair hearings on it. He says his attitude toward President Clinton's conduct of foreign policy hinges on such a delay, which the president is against. Helms' leader, incoming Majority Leader Dole, is against Helms on this, too, providing that the president will accept a separate bill,
which could extricate us from the World Trade Organization if we were getting adverse decisions.
As the agreement stands, the World Trade Organization could pressure America into changing environmental and other laws, an amount of influence nobody's ever had over the United States. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
French officials are issuing warnings for commuter planes as a result of the recent Indiana commuter plane crash. France's General Direction of Civil Aviation has urged crews worldwide flying two types of commuter planes not to fly on automatic pilot during ice buildups or bad turbulence. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow rose 18.5 points to close at 3,845. This is NPR. The UN Security Council has welcomed Iraq's formal recognition of Kuwait. This comes after 3 days of haggling. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz presented the Security Council President, UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright, with papers showing Iraq's action. Baghdad now recognizes Kuwait as an independent nation within borders set out by the UN last year. Iraqi recognition of Kuwait is considered central to ending Baghdad's claim that Kuwait is Iraq's 19th province. Baghdad has used that argument to justify its invasion of the emirate. A self-described conservative media watchdog group has released a guide designed to help parents monitor their children's TV viewing. Dean Olscher reports.
Brent Bozell's Media Research Center analyzed primetime entertainment programs and then ranked them according to how much they conformed to the center's view of what's appropriate for children to watch. If the organization felt a show had no political content and contained no anti-family messages, it gave that show a green light. Home Improvement got one. Yellow lights went to shows the group considered offensive to conservatives or inappropriate for younger viewers, like Northern Exposure.
It's promoted feminism, radical environmentalism. It's featured a homosexual wedding.
And Bozell said Married with Children was the worst offender. It was given a red light.
Anybody who would stand up and defend that program as having any redeeming values for a child is pathetically sick.
Bozell plans next to distribute this guide to advertisers. For National Public Radio, this is Dean Olscher in Washington.
Two Hispanic groups are calling for a boycott of California to protest Proposition 187. That's the voter-approved initiative denying nearly all public services to illegal immigrants. The head of Mexican-American Democrats of Texas says that if California does not want his people do not want to do business in California. He says people should ban anything connected to California, even Mickey Mouse. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of acting obscurity, Chaz Palminteri is doing good. He co-stars in Woody Allen's latest film, Bullets Over Broadway. He plays a small-time gangster forced to babysit his boss's actress girlfriend. She's a lousy actress, preparing for a part the director was strong-armed into giving her. Here's Palminteri in a scene where he's reluctantly rehearsing with her. The actress is played by Jennifer Tilly.
Can't you see? You're living out the exact same pattern your mother lived out with your father.
I am? Pray tell.
In some way, you're trying to relive it, and in the process of reliving it, correct it. As if that were possible. Ha!
It don't say ha.
Don't say ha. I added that.
What do you mean you added that? Are you allowed to do that?
We're allowed to add things.
How could you just add something?
You're allowed to add things. It's called ad-libbing.
You can't do that.
I can do that. What do you know? You don't know nothing. Shut up and read.
I think the whole thing stinks,
I
all
think
right?
You're a degenerate zombie. Shut up
you
and read.
Shut up.
You shut up and read.
Just shut up.
You shut up.
You're lucky you're Nick's girl.
You're lucky you're an idiot.
Well, it turns out this gangster has a natural gift for writing. And there is a parallel in Palminteri's life. His acting career took off after he wrote a semi-autobiographical one-man show for himself. Inspired by the show's success, he adapted it into the film A Bronx Tale. Robert De Niro directed the film and co-starred with Palminteri. It was Palminteri's breakthrough role. I talk with him first about Bullets Over Broadway. I asked Palminteri if Woody Allen wrote the role for him or if he had to read for the part.
We were editing Bronx Tale at the time, Bob De Niro and myself, and then I got a call that Woody Allen wanted to meet me. So I went down to his studio. I walked in and I said hi, and we talked for about 30 seconds. And then he said, would you mind reading a scene for me? And I said, no, not at all. I read a scene and he said, that was it. Thank you. So I left. And I got a call about 5 days later that he would like to see me again. I went in, I walked in, and he said, how are you? I said, fine. He said, you know, would you really mind reading just one more scene for me? And I said, no, I have no problem with that at all, Woody. And I read another scene for him, and he said, thank you. And I walked out, and about an hour later, they called me, and they said, I got the part.
What did you relate to in your role as Cheech, the gangster who turns out to have an incredible gift for writing?
Besides being an actor, I am a writer. I really tuned in to Cheech. I really felt what he felt about, you know, standing his ground. I mean, that's very similar to what happened to me in A Bronx Tale, in fact. When I wrote Bronx Tale, the one-man show, and I performed it on stage, everyone loved it and all the studios wanted it, but they didn't want me in the role. They just wanted a star in the role. And so I just held my ground. The offers kept getting higher and higher, and I just still held my ground. Even when the offers reached seven figures, I still said no. Until finally, they made the movie with me, with the help of, obviously, Robert De Niro, who saw me on stage and said, hey, you would be great in the role. I'll play Lorenzo. I'll direct it. Let's make the movie.
Why did you hold out until you could star in it? Why didn't you just take the money and run?
Because this was my shot, and I was not going to let it go away. I mean, a lot of people said I was crazy, that it wasn't going to happen, that I was going to blow the whole deal, but I really believed in myself and knew that this movie was going to get made because it was just too good.
So you ended up getting the part and the money.
Yes, I did.
You did good.
That's correct.
A Bronx Tale, the movie which grew out of your one-man show, is pretty autobiographical. And it's about a boy who witnesses a murder and then refuses to talk with the police about it.
Right.
And the local mob head, and thanks to the kid for not talking to the police, takes him under his wing. And then the kid's father and the mobster kind of fight for control over the kid's mind. Did you witness a murder when you were young?
Yes, I did. I witnessed a murder when I was about 9. I sat on my stoop. Basically, just the way it happened in the movie, that's the way it happened. Except I didn't have to wait. The cops didn't bring me down. I didn't have to witness anything. You know, I mean, I didn't have to, like, point anybody out of a lineup. That I just wrote for dramatic purposes.
For our listeners who may not have seen the movie, would you describe what you saw?
I was sitting on my stoop, and there was two cars parking. They were fighting for a parking space, and one guy got out with a baseball bat and broke the window of the guy in the back trying to sneak in the space, and the other guy got out with a gun and killed him.
Now, the movie, the kid assumes, wow, what a fight over a parking spot.
Right. I thought it was over a parking space, but years later I found out it wasn't.
What was it about?
I never found out what it was about, but I knew it wasn't over a parking space. My father would never tell me.
So it was about some mob thing or another?
It was a street thing. God knows what it was about.
Now, did the mob guy who did the hit become your mentor, as in the movie?
No. There was basically what I did was the guy was a conglomeration of a lot of different characters that I knew, and some of myself. It was just this basic thing that I wanted to put the working man against the mafiosa and the boy in the middle.
So did you hang out with wise guys?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah, and back in those days in the neighborhood, everybody hung out together, Terry. It was a very unique thing. Bad guys and good guys all hung out on the corner. It was very different back then. And when one guy had to do something, he just walked away and did what he had to do. So we all kind of like melted into each other.
Was there anything you found seductive about that world?
Well, when you're very young, it's impressionable. You see the cars, the money, the women, the clothes. You know, you think that's what life's about. But as you get older, you realize what my father was telling me, that the working man was really the tough guy. It doesn't take much strength to pull the trigger. It, you know, takes a lot of strength to get up in the morning and work for a living.
So, you know, when you were, what, 9 when you saw the murder?
Yes.
Did it scare you? What impact did it have on you?
No, it didn't scare me. It just stayed in my... people always ask me that. It's the amazing thing was when the guy killed him, he just kind of turned and stared at me. And I stared at him and our eyes met and he was looking at me. And I mean, it's so long ago and I think he was looking at me with the eyes of like, my God, I'm sorry this kid had to see this. And that's what it felt like to me when I go back and I remember it. And then the next thing I knew, my father grabbed me by my arm and dragged me upstairs.
What did your father say to you?
He just said, my father wouldn't talk about it. He said, forget it. And I said, but Daddy, it was a parking space. What? He said, forget it. He would not talk about it. I mean, he's the old school Sicilian, you know. When something like that was done in the neighborhood, you don't talk about it.
What do you think would have happened to you if you did talk about it?
I don't know. It wouldn't have been good. I mean, we probably would have had to pack up and move. I don't know.
Have you spoken to your father about that incident?
Yes.
As an adult?
Yes.
And what?
He says still the same thing. I said, Dad, now that it's over, years have gone by, and it's a movie, and everybody knows about it, what was it about? And he still gives me the same answer. You know, things, people, mistakes. He speaks in non sequiturs. You know, he still never tells me. Will not say it.
Now, how do you think he knows?
He knows. Well, I know he knows, because I can look in his eyes, and he smiles.
My guest is actor Chaz Palminteri. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Chaz Palminteri, co-star of Bullets Over Broadway. He also wrote the screenplay for and co-starred in the film A Bronx Tale. It's based on his childhood memories of gangsters in the neighborhood. Palminteri plays a gangster who takes a kid under his wing after the kid witnesses a murder but doesn't squeal. Here's Palminteri trying to win over the kid.
So you must be pretty upset after the Yankees lost.
Bill Mazeroski. I hate him. He made Mickey Mantle cry. Paper said that the Mick was crying.
Mickey Mantle, is that what you're upset about? Mickey Mantle makes $100,000 a year. How much does your father make?
I don't know.
You don't know? Well, see, if your father can't pay the rent, go ask Mickey Mantle and see what he tells you. Mickey Mantle don't care about you, so why should you care about him? Nobody cares.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Did you shoot that man over Balkan space?
When you get old, you'll understand.
Now, how did you get interested in acting?
It was something that I always wanted to do. Acting was something that was always inside of me. I remember seeing Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, and I said, my God, you know, how does he do that? You know, it was just something inside of me that I always wanted to do.
What were some of the early roles that you got in TV shows and in movies?
I did a show called Wise Guy for a while. I played a governor, a district attorney who was running for governor, which was really nice. And then I did another Wise Guy where I played the head of the mafia, which was totally opposite.
Was there something that functioned as the last straw for you in deciding, well, I'm going to just write my own show and take control of my own career because I don't like the direction
right.
I'm heading in?
There was. I was, you know, doing television work and really trying to keep, above water. And I was working at a doorman at a club in Los Angeles at the time. And I walked in one day and the doorman and the owner said to me, listen, I have to let you go. And I said, why? He says, well, I just change doormen every 6 months. That's just the way I do things. So I got basically fired, you know, right there. And I was really upset about it. And he said, I'm sorry, you did a great job, but this is the way it is. And I walked out. I got in my beat up 1974 Honda with a big dent on the side. I drove back to North Hollywood. I was living in this one room dump there. And I sat on the edge of my bed and I said, I looked in the mirror and I said, I cannot believe my life is, you know, I cannot get above water. I felt like I had all this talent, but I couldn't really, you know, I couldn't really show it. So I said, well, if they won't give me a great part, I'm going to write my own. I got back in my car, drove to Thrifty Drugstore. I got 5 tabs of yellow legal paper and I started to write A Bronx Tale. And I turned my life around.
So when you decided to write A Bronx Tale, you knew that you'd kind of draw on your past and then...
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I knew that, you know, I always wanted to write about that killing I saw when I was 9 years old, so I just wrote this 5-minute monologue. I started it there. Then each week I would go back and write a little, I would write a lot during the week and I would perform it on Monday nights.
Now, when you were doing this as a one-man show, you did, like 18 different parts or something?
18 different characters, right.
So who were some of the characters that you took on?
Well, there's Eddie Mush, the born loser. You know, they called him Eddie Mush because everything he touched turned to mush. He was just totally a loser. There was Frankie Coffee Cake. He had a face like it looked like a Drake's Coffee Cake. He had all this acne. There was Jojo the Whale, who was like as big as a house. I mean, you know, people used to say you didn't walk with Jojo, you walked among him. You know, you know, I mean, the guy was so big he had his own zip code, they used to say. I mean, it was really, I mean, there were funny stories about a lot of these guys.
Were these guys real?
Yes, a lot of them were, yeah, sure. Eddie Mush was in the movie. I put him in Bronx Tale.
Oh, no, what did he play?
He played Eddie Mush.
Oh.
He played himself. I was a little worried because, I mean, he's such a loser that I was afraid he was going to jinx the movie. You know, I really got scared by it. In fact, the first day he showed up on the set, it rained, and we had to, like, go to a cover set, which I said, oh, my God, I can't believe this.
So did being in the movie change his luck?
Well, he made him a lot of money. I don't know where it is now. I mean, knowing Eddie, he probably used the racetrack. Who knows?
So were you anxious to see what people from the neighborhood thought of the movie?
Yeah. A lot of them really liked it a lot.
And the others?
Some of them just thought that, you know, well, you know, you portray the neighborhood, it was a little racist. And I said, well, it was racist. You know, there was a lot of the neighborhood wasn't like that, but some of it was. I mean, to portray the good, you have to say some of the bad. It's just that simple. Don't get me wrong. It's a wonderful, wonderful neighborhood. I loved it. Hardworking people. But was it a little racist sometimes? Absolutely.
Well, where the racism comes in the movie is that the teenager playing you has a crush on...
Right. On a black girl.
On a black teenager, right. Yeah. And so as they're trying to kind of get together, meanwhile, all of his friends in the neighborhood right. are just... like beaten up on young black men who
right.
who come through the neighborhood, and that leads to kind of bigger and bigger fights into
right.
other plot twists I won't get into. But were there things like that going on in the neighborhood where if a black kid came into the neighborhood,
absolutely,
he'd have to be careful of his life
all the time. Yes, at that time, yes, absolutely.
And did you ever go along with that?
In the beginning, I did, yes. But then in the end, I started to realize this was wrong. You know, why were we fighting with people just because they were a different color than us? I thought it was wrong. And I wanted to show in the movie where, if you remember that little scene that I wrote, the scene between Slick and little Collodio and the young boy when they're nine, sitting on a stoop and the bus goes by with the black kids in it, and the boy throws... he throws a stickball bat at them, and he says, "What are you doing?" He says, "They're just driving through," and he says, "They're coming from school." So the little Slick says, "Well, how do you know?" He says, "Well, my father told me." And Slick says, "Well, that's because, yeah, well, my father told me that's how it starts." You know, so I wanted to show how racism, you know, and hatred is bred down from one generation to the next, in that little incident right there, and what happens when Slick, when he gets older, you know, it ends up being his demise. He dies from that.
Actor Chaz Palminteri is my guest. He stars in the new movie Bullets Over Broadway, Woody Allen's film, and he also wrote and starred in A Bronx Tale, which was directed by Robert De Niro. Now, you wrote a screenplay that you're starring in the movie of. Paul Mazursky is directing it. It's called Faithful.
That's correct.
I think it's scheduled to open in 1995. What's it about?
Faithful is a script. It was originally a play that I wrote, and I adapted into a screenplay. It's about a guy who... this guy's a hitman. He gets sent to kill, we think, he gets sent to kill this woman who lives in this big mansion upstate with her husband. Her husband hired him because his wife cheated on him once. He's been cheating on her for the past 20 years. She cheated on him once, which he says to the guy, and he wants her dead. But we don't really know who's lying. It's kind of like this thriller. It's funny. It's very touching. But it's like we never know who's telling the truth until the end.
Now, some Italian-American actors complain that they're always forced into these mafia hitman kind of roles. Mm. And you're writing roles like that for yourself.
Yeah.
Tell me why you're so interested in it. Does it date back to that killing you witnessed when you were nine, or is there something else behind it?
Well, it's a very good way for me to explore these universal themes that I like to explore. One was in Bronx Tale was the mafioso against the working man. In Faithful, it's basically good and evil. It's about infidelity and about what makes a man faithful and what makes a woman faithful. You know, if a woman's afraid to cheat on her husband, does that really make her faithful? If a man is too ugly to find somebody else, does that really make him faithful? You know, it's about put people in the position when they have money, do they change? You know, what does money do to a human being? And that's what I wrote about in Faithful, and that's what the movie's about.
What do your parents have to say about the success you've been having and about the ability to actually see you on the big screen?
Well, I mean, the big benefit that I have is I've always said, because my parents were so instrumental in my success, when my father and mother would always push me and said that, you know, you're going to make it. Even when I was 9, 10 years old, they used to say, you're going to make it, you're special, something's going to happen, trust us. So they gave me the confidence to really, maybe when I had to hold out for all that money at that time, I really had it. And I got to say that they were like my backbone there. So now it's like really great. You know, I bought them a great place in Florida, and they had a new car, and they're really so happy with my success. I mean, I get more happiness watching them be happy for me than I am for myself, to be honest with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chaz Palminteri co-stars in Bullets Over Broadway. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're taking a look at the new chairman of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, Jesse Helms, and what possible effect he may have on the general agreement on tariffs and trade and some other of President Clinton's plans for international relationships. Also, the impact on the states of this whole new political world that we are living in here in Washington, where the Republicans are running the Senate and the House. Patty Namet is doing a piece on nurses. Their job is being redefined as they pick up some of the duties of doctors and aides take over professional nursing duties. And we have a story about Hannibal Peterson, a jazz trumpeter turned to opera turned reformer.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. To the general public, Harvey Pekar may be best known for his cantankerous appearances on David Letterman, but Pekar first established his reputation as the writer of a highly realistic autobiographical comic book called American Splendor. Now Pekar and his wife Joyce Brabner have collaborated on a book-length nonfiction comic called Our Cancer Year. Ken Tucker has a review.
The first great achievement of Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner's Our Cancer Year is its blithe assumption that a comic book can be a medium for adult concerns for a strictly observed autobiography, that there's no reason in the world why a comic strip cannot bear the weight of narratives about cancer and political repression. Our Cancer Year tells two stories simultaneously. Pekar reveals that in 1990 he was diagnosed with cancer and spent the next year undergoing exhausting, painful chemotherapy sessions. Joyce Brabner, meanwhile, was becoming increasingly involved with the plight of activists in Cambodia and the Middle East. Set in the time just before Operation Desert Storm, Our Cancer Year also details Brabner's efforts to protest what she viewed as misguided foreign policy. Neither Pekar nor Brabner tries to idealize behavior or personality here. Harvey comes across as perpetually cranky, suspicious, and pessimistic. Joyce seems coldly pragmatic, full of political passion, but also very humorless. Both middle-aged, they live a working-class bohemian life in Cleveland, pinching pennies and worrying about how to pay the bills. Harvey's cancer is a financial as well as an emotional burden. Many pages are given over to discussions of his insurance plan and the lousy state of health care in America. I know a lot of people who are put off by Pekar's work. My wife won't read him because she finds all his stories too unrelentingly depressing. But I'm almost always thrilled by Pekar's ferocious lack of sentimentality. He doesn't go for cheap literary despair. Pekar has written about his admiration for various Russian writers, especially Chekhov, and it's not overstating the case here to say that Pekar's best writing approaches that state of exquisite anguish that we've come to call Chekhovian. There's an extraordinarily moving moment in Our Cancer Year when Harvey and Joyce are lying in bed at night. Harvey is in such pain he can't fall asleep. Joyce has been thinking how much she misses the furry hair on her husband's chest because of his chemo treatments. The two lie close, yet isolated, each not wanting to disturb the other. The caption on the drawing is, "Joyce lies without moving. Harvey pretends to sleep." Our Cancer Year is a thick comic book illustrated by Frank Stack, who supplies black and white panels with a minimum of pictorial detail. They look like hastily drawn sketches, which suits the urgency underlying the themes of this book. By the end of the story, we're told that Harvey's cancer is in remission. Here's hoping he remains well enough to create more work that cuts this close to the bone.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Our Cancer Year by Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet two Southern women who've spent their lives in the world of politics. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has written a new book about taking care of sick loved ones at home. And Lindy Boggs has written a memoir about her life in politics, first as a congressman's wife, then as a member of Congress herself. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.